Soundworks.
Soundworks.
From PRI.
I'm Farai Chidea, and this is One with Farai, a part of Soundworks from PRI. On our show, we get a previous guest to ask a question of our current guest. So take a listen.
Name one thing that is within the realm of the politically feasible that could be done to reduce economic inequality in the United States.
And here's how our upcoming guest answered.
I would say raise the minimum wage. I think would be a good first step.
On One with Farai, we're joined by Bird Runningwater, the director of the Sundance Institute's Native American and Indigenous Program. Bird, it's great to talk to you again.
It's great to hear your voice.
First of all, let's explain for people the difference between the Sundance Film Festival and the Sundance Institute, just so we get that clear.
Okay. Well, the Sundance Institute, which was founded by Robert Redford back in 1981, has six major programs. And those programs are the feature film program, the documentary film program, the film music program, the theater program, and the Sundance Film Festival is a program of the Institute, in addition to my program, which is the Native American and Indigenous program.
And so what's that?
Well, the Native program, as we call it in an abbreviated form, really exists because of the mandate of Mr. Redford. There's a little bit of backstory. I guess, you know, back probably 40 years ago, 35 years ago, he was asked to audition to play a Native role on television, which he particularly resented, which kind of led him on a quest to kind of seek out, like, where are the Native actors? And it kind of sent him on another quest to find out where are the Native writers and directors, where are the Native filmmakers? And he eventually found some and created kind of some mentorship kind of training programs, which really inspired the founding of the Institute, you know, to support filmmakers in their artist journey.
And so, you know, I have had the pleasure of coming out to the campus that you guys have, where you do a lot of programs to allow fledgling and experienced writers and directors to come and really immerse themselves in their craft. But what exactly do you offer to the filmmakers that you work with and nurture?
The Sundance Institute really created what's considered the lab model that I think a lot of people really borrow today and a lot of artist support programs around the world. And that model, that lab model, is really about supporting filmmakers and artists in a development process where we bring in creative advisors, established filmmakers who serve as mentors and really support and work with, you know, the filmmakers that we select through our very competitive programs. And the intent is really about, you know, supporting the craft, you know, whether it's screenwriting or directing, editing, storytelling, but also really protecting the original and authentic voice of the artist so that that voice really shines through and permeates the work. We are really known for the discovery of new and exciting artists.
Tell me about one or two of the people who've gone through the Native American and Indigenous program.
Yeah, well, we've had so many that we've been able to support over the years, going back to, I think, you know, someone like Chris Eyre, who was the director of Smoke Signals, which premiered back in 1998.
Don't you even know how to be a real Indian?
I guess not.
Well, shit, no wonder. Jeez. I guess I'll have to teach you then, ain't it?
First of all, quit grinning like an idiot. Indians ain't supposed to smile like that. Get stoic. You gotta look mean or people won't respect you. White people will run all over you if you don't look mean. You gotta look like a warrior. You gotta look like you just came back from killing a buffalo.
But our tribe never hunted buffalo, we were fishermen.
What? You wanna look like you just came back from catching a fish? This ain't Dances with Salmon, you know?
We've worked with people like Billy Luther, who made the documentary Miss Navajo.
Once you're Miss Navajo, you're always Miss Navajo.
Well, here we are, we're Native Americans, we're very much alive.
This is probably once-in-a-life opportunity for a Navajo girl.
If you win, you're going to be the representation of our tribe. Some people will see Miss Navajo one time in their lifetime, but that one impression is what they are going to think of us as a people.
We've also supported people like Sterling Harjo, who made Four Sheets to the Wind and Barking Water. So, you know, and most recently, Drunktown's finest director, Sydney Freeland. She's kind of just the newest one who's had a feature film premiere at Sundance Festival and is really kind of making the festival rounds right now.
I've seen many of the films, but not the last one that you mentioned. Drunktown's, what is it?
Drunktown's Finest.
So tell me a little bit about this film.
Starting with the title, you know, Sydney comes from the Navajo Nation, and she remembers being in elementary school when the community kind of became abuzz that there was a film crew, a news crew, filming in her hometown of Gallup, New Mexico. And, you know, they all weren't quite sure what they were filming, but, you know, they waited with great anticipation to see the news program on national TV. And whenever it did show on television, the title of the program was called Drunktown USA. You know, it had photographs of drunk Indians on the street and imagery of, you know, drunk Indians in jail and drunk Indians here, drunk Indians there. And she was really kind of perplexed because she's like, why are they showing, you know, this story and angle on my community, which is a very small part of it? Why didn't they go visit, you know, my uncle who's a jeweler, or, you know, my aunt who does regular things every day? And so, you know, she was really kind of inspired by the lack of complexity in that representation, which led her to develop this feature film.
Give us just a tiny taste of what the setup is for the feature.
Yeah, basically, you know, it's a coming of age story of three different young people on the Navajo reservation who are really kind of struggling, you know, with their everyday lives. And basically, they all kind of develop this idea that they need to get out of this town. They need to leave. They need to go discover the world in order to kind of be, you know, who they want to be. And, you know, and one of them is a former gangbanger who's about to be a dad. The other one is a young Christian girl who was adopted and raised by a non-Native family. And the third is a transsexual character who dreams of becoming a supermodel.
So here's a scene from Drunktown's Finest.
They say this land isn't a place to live, it's a place to leave. Then why do people stay?
When you first walked into my office, you told me you wanted to provide a better life for you and your family. But you gotta understand, joining the army is not a right, it's a privilege.
You're adopted?
Yeah. My real parents died in a car crash when I was 7. I'm here looking for my biological family.
Who is?
Felicia from Facebook.
Oh, hey, girl.
What are you up to?
Sweet call.
Maybe my family is a bunch of drunks, but I will be the one to judge that. Me.
So, Bert, explain how you worked with director Sydney Freeland to achieve this work.
Well, basically, I had my eye on her because I had seen some short films that she had made. And I recognized, you know, that there was kind of, you know, some talent percolating. There was something going on there with her point of view. And so, you know, I made contact with her and asked her if she ever, you know, intended to direct feature films. And she said yes. And this was probably back in 2008. And so she sent me a draft of this script, which became Drunktown's Finest. And so we accepted her to be in the Native Lab, which is our early stage development program for Native filmmakers, and set her up with one-on-ones with filmmakers, established filmmakers, people like Allison Anders and Casey Lemons and the late Merita Mitta and Sterling Harjo. And all of these writers' advisors really started helping her to develop the script and give feedback and really help her get to a next draft. And after she did that, she then applied to our feature film program, and it got accepted into that really highly competitive program to begin kind of a deeper development process at the writing stage. And then she was accepted to our director's lab that the feature film program runs. And at that point, you know, she was shooting test scenes from the script. Robert Redford was one of the creative advisors who worked with her on set and in the editing room. And he really became a big fan of Sydney's, and really, you know, because of his close New Mexico ties, eventually came on board on the film as an executive producer.
And you also mentioned among the films that have been through some part of your pipeline, Miss Navajo, and I really loved that documentary.
Yeah.
And how it portrayed all of these different young women with a deep attachment to their culture, but also, you know, everyday issues, modern life, you know. And how do you think Native Americans, I understand that people who are non-Indian call Indians Native Americans. So I will probably, you know, go back and forth.
Well, I think the more colloquial term that the Native community, see, I use Native, but that the American Indian community uses within itself is we refer to each other as Indians, even right. though, you know, it's a misnomer. But it's just something that's
But should
colloquial.
I use Native American?
Sure. You can use whatever you want.
So, in any case, I loved watching Miss Navajo. And how do you think Native Americans, Indians, First Nation people are generally faring in the kind of cultural media space in terms of both outward definition by non-Native filmmakers, television producers, and also inwardly in terms of representation by people from the communities?
Wow. It's such a complex world right now within, you know, entertainment and media and whatnot. I think mostly because there's such huge shifts happening in terms of the way that just American audiences are consuming content in general. And so, you know, there's a lot of work happening in television, like with the First Nations Experience, which is a new Native American channel that launched a couple years ago. And that's kind of a PBS public broadcasting model that I think is really working interestingly. It's being picked up across the country, and they're creating original programming and acquiring a lot of existing programming. There's always Native radio, which, you know, goes across the whole country. Like, I was just on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation and did an interview on Keeley Radio, which is a Oglala Lakota radio station that really serves the community. And there's a lot of great work happening that's a lot of very community-based, very regionally and tribally specific as well, that doesn't a lot of times travel outside of that. But I think a lot of it is tied to, you know, tribal sovereignty and a lot of cultural revitalization and language work that's happening right now, because a lot of radios are broadcasting in their own languages. So, you know, it's a really rich and complex world.
Yeah, I've met some of the people in public radio who are working on stations that are bilingual, and there seems to be a real vibrancy there. But let me ask you, and I know that, you know, it's always like a mixed blessing when you're asked to speak on behalf of people. So I am not trying to get you to speak on behalf of all Indian people, but I just...
Thank you.
You are someone who not only is yourself Native, but also you do travel because of your work. You are a sort of cultural ambassador, and you go to a lot of different spaces and interact with people. And just give us a little perspective on something like tribal sovereignty. I remember being in the room at the Unity Journalism Conference where a Native American journalist asked President George W. Bush about tribal sovereignty, and his answer devolved into complete and utter incomprehension. Like, he just said, basically, tribal sovereignty is tribal sovereignty or something along those lines. Like, he just was like, I don't know what it is, or if I do, I'm not going to touch it.
Yeah.
So just explain that concept.
Yeah, well, you know, it is political terminology. Going back to the original question, it's like, I get to visit a lot of communities across the United States and internationally, you know, Australia, New Zealand, Canada. Just a couple years ago, I got to go visit the Sami people who exist in the Arctic Circle across Scandinavia.
I almost went there this summer.
Yeah, it's such an interesting and beautiful place, you know. Lots of reindeer. But
that's the Native indigenous Europeans. That's another whole fascinating thing, because most people think of indigenous in terms of non-European cultures.
Yeah.
And so the Sami people fascinate me.
Yeah. But, you know, one of the things that is really interesting is, you know, the idea of sovereignty and tribal sovereignty is really kind of, it can be contextualized in a global sense under that idea of First Nations, which is, you know, people who had original occupancy of particular lands and then, you know, ideally have had to deal with, you know, a level of colonization. But one of the fortunate things for Native Americans is that we, because when, you know, the French and the British arrived, you know, on the East Coast, they engaged in a treaty-making process with the first Native peoples that they came upon. And that served as a foundation, along with us being mentioned in the Declaration of Independence and being mentioned in the U.S. Constitution, really provided a basis and a legal framework and an entire canon of American law, which is considered Indian law, to allow us to really exist today as what I guess the Supreme Court of the United States has defined as quasi-sovereign entities, allowing us to maintain reservations and land bases, and for us to have tribal governments who are charged with upholding, you know, the sovereignty of a tribal nation and to serve, you know, the citizens of that tribal nation.
And that can get into everything from different land use laws to mm-hmm. whether or not a tribe can print a license plate, any number of different legal issues. But there are so many different nations within the United States and Canada. How do you think that we can develop a better framework for understanding the diversity of different Native communities?
Yeah, you know, I think that's definitely one of the challenges. I think we're up to 500, there's more than 560 tribes that currently exist within the United States, and they all have their own, you know, governments and courts and police systems and, you know, everything that any other kind of sovereign entity would have. You know, I think film is really one of those things, and storytelling is one of those things that can really unify people, because, you know, you're telling stories, basically stories about human beings. But I also think trying to get, you know, an audience to identify with an experience. And I think Native storytelling is one of those areas that's really the freshest in terms of American cinema, and trying to portray an experience to a broader audience and have them identify with it.
So you've mentioned films including Smoke Signals, Miss Navajo, and Drunk Town's Finest. What other films come to mind that you think people might want to check out if they want to see compelling film about Native communities?
One of our alumni is a Maori filmmaker named Taika Waititi, and he made a film called Boy, which was based on a short film that we screened at our festival about 10 years ago that went on to be nominated for an Oscar. We supported him again through, you know, our screenwriters labs and directors labs to help nurture that feature film. And it became the highest grossing New Zealand made film in their country. I think it, you know, performed at around $10 or $11 million at the box office.
Kia ora, my name is Boy. And welcome to my interesting world. My favorite person is Michael Jackson.
Wanna see some Michael Jackson dance moves?
My favorite subjects are art, social studies.
I'll kick both your nuts off, and you'll have none.
And Michael Jackson.
Sir, boy.
Hey, boy.
Thank you, boy.
I'm named after my dad. He's overseas doing some pretty important stuff.
Who are you?
Boy.
All right. I'm your dad.
Also, a film we supported through a lab that we set up in Australia for Indigenous filmmakers there, this film called Samson and Delilah by Warwick Thornton, that premiered at the Cannes Film Festival and that won the Best First Feature Prize, which is called the Camera d'Or. It's a really stunning film, and it kind of has a bit of an ache, a bit of a tragic ache to it, but I think is, at the same time, is really inspiring. And on the American side, we had a film called On the Ice by Andrew McLean, who belongs to the Inupiaq people of northern Alaska, Barrow, Alaska, which is the northernmost part of the United States in the Arctic Circle. And, you know, he made this thriller called On the Ice about, you know, teenagers today up in that community.
What is it, son?
It's James. He fell through the ice.
Warm up the machines.
Start calling the guys.
Get everybody over here.
I need a satellite picture of the ice conditions. Tell me what happened.
You're listening to One with Farai, part of Soundworks from PRI, and I'm speaking with Bird Runningwater of the Sundance Institute about innovations in Native and Indigenous film. Let me ask you about your background, Cheyenne and Mescalero Apache. Tell me about the tribes that you're from and their history, and, you know, just give us a taste. I'm not going to ask you to give us a history lesson, but tell us a little bit about your life.
It might take me 4 days to tell you our creation narrative.
That's good. I'm good for it. I don't know the studio is.
Well, you know, my mother is Cheyenne, which is a tribe that's located in two places, within Oklahoma and Montana, but we come from the Oklahoma group of Cheyennes. And my father's tribe is Mescalero Apache, actually coming from two bands of Apaches, the Mescalero Apache and the Chiricahua Apache. Chiricahua, I think, are most well known as being Geronimo's band. You know, I feel very fortunate. My parents met at an Indian boarding school in the 60s, and you know, fell in love and got married. And, you know, and they were coming from a generation that was really sent to boarding schools as an effort to, you know, these government-run boarding schools as an effort to mainstream them. And I think when they got together and had children, they tried to figure out, I think, the best way for us to be immersed within our cultures, within our languages, and to really ensure that we had, you know, a cultural perspective on our lives and in the world. And I'm so grateful to them for having done that. And so, you know, I grew up in a really rich childhood with, you know, with my Cheyenne grandparents who, you know, really spoke Cheyenne to me. And I remember my grandparents raised me while my parents were away at college, and after they graduated, they scooped me back up and took me to my father's reservation in New Mexico. And I remember going to my first day of second grade at this new school on the reservation, and on the playground, everybody was speaking Apache. And it was my first really introduction to Apache and my father's tribe and everything. And I just remember being really perplexed, thinking, oh my God, I have to figure this out. Mm. And, you know, so it was great. But, you know, and I was fortunate on one level, my parents' languages are unrelated. So they have to speak to each other in English. And so I grew up, you know, multilingual with English and, you know, Cheyenne, and learned Apache. And then, you know, we're Southern New Mexico, so I heard a lot of Spanish, so I spoke Spanish. And, you know, being multilingual, I think, really helped me, you know, advance in the world and being able to adjust to different scenarios, situations, cultures, and whatnot. Unfortunately, the school system back then, because a lot of my peers and classmates were first language Apache speakers, got put into learning disability classes, and their educational path was really, really tough because of the language barrier. And it was, I think, something that just really inspired some of the work that I do even today by including, you know, indigenous languages in film. And I love, you know, American films to have subtitles, which I think is, yeah, you know, representative of our own complexity as a nation.
It sounds like you learned a lot of resilience and adaptability from your childhood because of having to move at a young age and having to be thrust into a new tribal culture and linguistic culture. But you also mention some of the educational inequities that seem to exist where you were.
Yeah.
Is that something that you think has been remedied? Have you kept up on what's been going on with the schools?
Well, you know, one of the things that I'm really proud of today is within national political conversations, you know, like with organizations like the National Congress of American Indians and the National Indian Education Association, you know, these large kind of policy-oriented groups. You know, I remember, you know, 15 years ago where, you know, the idea of indigenous language revitalization was just barely an idea. And, you know, flash forward, you know, 15 years, it's become common practice. You know, almost every tribe has some type of language revitalization program because of those failed educational policies from, you know, from my youth, where they really, and even my parents' generation, where the idea was to mainstream people. English was the goal, you know, be able to speak English properly. And so nowadays we're really kind of shifting back towards, you know, creating more speakers of indigenous languages. And that's part of the work that I did when I worked for the Fund of the Four Directions, one of the Rockefeller family members. You know, the work that I got to do was to fund tribal communities to create new speakers of their languages. And at that point, you know, like I said, it was just an idea. The immersion language model was slowly moving from the Maori people of New Zealand up to Hawaii, where Native Hawaiians were establishing, you know, immersion programs. And then that model eventually moved over to North America, where, you know, it's practiced quite a bit today.
You mentioned the boarding schools where your parents met, but, you know, I've met so many people who they or members of their family were all but kidnapped, basically, to some of these boarding schools during the 60s. And it seems to be a chapter in our history that we have not yet processed as a nation.
Yeah. And, you know, and it is a part of our history. And it's something that a lot of people are starting to tell today. One of the more interesting perspectives that we supported on film, actually probably about 4 or 5 years ago, was a film by Black Horse Low called Shimasani, which in the Navajo language means my grandmother. And it's an interesting take. It's this grandmother's story about how growing up, her brother was sent off to boarding school, but would kept running away and coming home because they were mean and they would mistreat him. So in the film, he actually tells a story about two sisters where one of the sisters gets sent to boarding school, the other one has to stay home, which creates a scenario where the girl who's staying home really wants to go to boarding school and decides to run away to go to boarding school just because she's interested in to see where her sister is. And, you know, her sister brings her books and, you know, so it's an interesting flip on, you know, the traditional narrative of boarding school.
Yeah. No, I mean, it sounds like the kinds of films that are being produced have a richness of meaning. And yet, the things that often are the most heavily rewarded in our consumer society are things that don't really have a lot of meaning but make a lot of box office. Mm-hmm. So how do you get native films to also reach mainstream audiences?
Yeah. Well, I think that's one of our biggest challenges as a film community. I guess the idea of, you know, a native person on the big screen is still highly sought after by the native audience because it doesn't happen so often. But, you know, at the same time, you know, when if we're looking at the marketplace and independent film, you know, I have to take studios and networks kind of out of the equation for this. But, you know, for the independent marketplace and the art house market, you know, we have to make films that'll really cross over and serve the broadest audience possible, mostly because the native audience as a marketplace hasn't yet quite been defined. And so we can't just rely on performance with native audiences. We actually have to think about stories that travel and that reach broader audiences with the hopes of, you know, potential acquisition and distribution, which has still yet to come because a lot of distributors are really perplexed by native films. They don't quite know what to do with them. The formulas that they apply to every, you know, art house film, you know, to reach what they call the art house audiences, which is older, white, more affluent, are what they've developed their formulas around. And so I don't think there's much effort to try to create new formulas. And so I think that's one of the areas that my program is really going to try to look at working on in the future, is really trying to define the native audience and look at what the potential performance could be for a film playing, you know, in theaters on reservations or in theaters with high native populations. You know, again, going back to how consumption of content is changing, digital distribution is huge. You know, native audiences now have access to so much of our historical programming that they never really had access to before. You know, and one of the things about the films that we've supported through our program, like Samson and Delilah, On the Ice, you know, Barking Water, all these films are playing some of the most prestigious film festivals around the world and winning awards. But, you know, our own native audiences have yet to see the films.
I want to turn to LGBTQ cinema within a Native context, because that's something that you've also been able to do, is to talk about gay, lesbian, queer, trans culture within the context of the Native film program. How did that develop, and how do you evaluate how to, you know, bring out different sub-themes within the work that you do?
Going back to the idea of culture and tradition and, you know, in the face of mainstreaming, you know, a lot of tribal societies, including, you know, my own tribes, have very complex societal structures, you know, and our communities see things in a very different way. And a lot of times beyond just the idea of two genders, you know, the Navajo tribe, you know, I think has been, through different research and identification, has come up with as many as four, even six genders within their community and within their societal structure. And with Drunk Town's Finest, the inclusion of that transsexual storyline, you know, there's a deep cultural theme. You know, I don't want to give too much away about the film because I want people to see it for themselves, but there is kind of a level of acceptance. You know, this young woman is being raised by her medicine man grandfather and very traditional grandmother, but, you know, they don't blink an eye at, you know, the son, their grandson's notion of wanting to live life as a woman. And there's a thread of a traditional story about how trans people existed back in the time of creation. And so there's a place within the societal structure and within ancestral narratives that I fear that we're going to lose that knowledge, you know, as we continue to become more mainstream. I feel like the more westernized and Americanized our tribes become, some of these notions are starting to fade away. And so it's really about kind of reminding our own native audience and sharing with, you know, the broadest audience possible that there are places in the world where, you know, we kind of have led the way in terms of acceptance.
Yeah. So, you know, despite your concerns about losing the traditions that seem to have a more expansive view of gender and sexuality, do you believe there are some positives in terms of what's going on now with LGBTQ native film and community at large?
Wow. Yeah. You know, I get so many requests often from a lot of the LGBT film festivals, you know, saying, you know, we're dying to show something native. And I definitely, you know, have seen that as an opportunity for filmmakers. And another film that we supported a couple years ago is a Chicano film called Mosquita y Mari by Aurora Guerrero. And, you know, and that's kind of a very personal story of her, you know, experience as a teenager and kind of, you know, exploring sexuality and awakening in terms of a first crush that she had in her life. And, you know, and so, like, you know, on the film side, there's very little work happening. So most of it that is happening, you know, we've been happy to support, mostly because the quality of the storytelling is just great in general. So that's kind of been the first idea, but also just because the perspectives they've been offering are so unique.
So as we wrap up, what's your dream? What's your vision, Bird, for where you take this program next?
Oh, wow. Well, I think I really would love to, for our filmmaking community to really attain a level of success, you know, and of films really being seen, I think, by the largest audiences possible. I know a lot of people kind of aspire, you know, maybe to win an Oscar or, you know, to kind of reach a particular platform of that, which I think, you know, would be nice. But I think a level of sustainability for Native filmmakers to continue working and to not have to max out credit cards to make a short film, but, you know, to actually be able to work and participate. And so I think really building a network with tribes across the country where films can circulate and screen and be seen and perform within that particular marketplace is definitely a dream of mine.
So, Bird, there's something we do on One with Farai, which is that we have a kind of baton relay where one guest gets to ask a question of the next guest. So here's one for you.
Name one thing that is within the realm of the politically feasible that could be done to reduce economic inequality in the United States.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. You just got dropped the bomb.
I would say raise the minimum wage. I think would be a good first step.
There you go.
And I just read an article that my mother's tribe, the Cheyenne Rapo tribes of Oklahoma, just raised the minimum wage across all five of their casinos and tribal employees.
Yeah, and in Seattle, the minimum wage is now $15, which is one of the highest, if not the highest, in the country. So it's a really interesting time for that. And I think that that's a very elegant answer. And your question came from former diplomat Alec Ross.
Wow.
You got one of the tough ones, but you nailed a very straightforward answer. It's always fun to do this. And you get to turn the tables and ask a question down the line for someone who you may not know or have ever met or may not ever meet. So you can ask anything you want.
I would be interested to know the last film that moved you to tears and why.
That is beautiful, Bird. Yeah. So fantastic. Well, Bird Running Water, the head of the Native American and Indigenous program at the Sundance Institute, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Farai.
You've been listening to One with Farai, a part of Soundworks from PRI. I'm your host and executive producer, Farai Chidea. This program is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and our theme music is by the band Betty. Catch our next installment when I sit down with longtime LGBT advocate and author, Irva Shivad.
One with Farai is supported in part by PRI's New Voices Fund, bringing new perspectives and personalities to public media. Donors to the fund include Maureen and Michael Rutgers and the Sarah and Evan Williams Foundation. Soundworks.
Soundworks
from PRI.